We are now in the first book of the Torah called Bereshit, and we're in Parashah Vayishlach. This is the eighth reading portion of the new annual Torah reading cycle for the Jewish year 5781. Vayishlach is Hebrew for "and he sent." And if you're reading from a Torah or a Jewish Bible, this reading begins in Genesis chapter 32, verse 4, and continues through Genesis chapter 36, verse 43. Now, if you're reading from a Christian Bible, it begins in Genesis chapter 32, verse 3. And this week's parasha is the continuation of Jacob's life story. Now, before we begin, let's do a review of last week's parasha Vayetze. And that story begins in Genesis chapter 28, verse 10, and it says, "And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran." Now, the main reason Jacob is going to Haran is because his twin brother Esau threatens to kill him. And there's another reason. Jacob's parents want him to get out of Beersheba to the house of Laban in Haran. And Rebekah's brother there is Laban, and he wants him to go find a wife. Now, before Jacob starts his journey to Haran, he first goes to his uncle Eber, where he studies the Torah for 14 years. Now, Eber was a great-grandson of Noah's son, Shem, a distant ancestor of Abraham. Now, soon after that, Jacob begins his travel to Haran. And we learn that Haran is symbolic of the dark forces of evil. And there he enters into a contract with his father-in-law, Laban, to marry Rachel, his little daughter. Now, when Jacob finally arrives in Haran and he sees Rachel for the first time, it was love at first sight. The moment he sees her, he knows she's the one he's been waiting for all his life, and he wants to marry her. And for the next 20 years, Jacob's story is about transforming life's imperfect moments into something that is good and positive. And he did it through the inner power of struggling within oneself to always look for the good and the positive, regardless of how dark the situation may look like. In truth, Jacob is the story of our own ongoing life struggle to turn all those bad situations into something that is miraculous and good. The symbolic message behind all of Jacob's struggle in this life was meant to show us that we too can succeed in our own life struggle, no matter how bad they may appear to you. Now, learning to turn our own bad situations into something that is good is a never-ending process. Now, when we can learn to take all our negative life moments and transform them into something that is good and positive, that's when the miraculous appears and it will begin to shape our lives into the image of our Creator. Our Creator designed us to become creators. Learning to take something that is bad and turn it into good is built into us. When God placed our soul into a fleshly body, it was for the purpose of elevating our soul. And the way we elevate our soul is by training the body to resist all that is negative and evil. It is the soul's job, once it awakens, to train the body to conform to all the rules of our heavenly Creator. When our soul begins to train itself to conform to God's will, that process of training, in essence, is the soul taking all the negative, lustful emotions and urges out of the thinking process of the body's stony heart. Much like when a person takes a chisel and a hammer and begins to carve out a water well from a stony rock so that it can hold water. The spiritual side being, the soul is chipping away at the stony heart of the body and carving out a water well carving out a water well for what purpose, you say? To hold God's living waters. Carving out a vessel from our soul is a daily and lifelong struggle that requires time, which also requires a mental discipline of loving God and loving our neighbor. Loving God and loving our neighbor is the soul's driving energy that creates the force to hew a well, that is a water well, from a stony heart. In the book of Ezekiel chapter 36, beginning to read in verse 26, it says, I should say God says, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and will give you a heart of flesh. Verse 27, and I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Now think about how long it took Abraham to physically dig a well. Why didn't Abraham let his servants dig the well? Because Abraham wanted to teach us, if you want God's light of holiness to dwell inside you, you must personally dig your own spiritual well out of your own soul. Abraham wanted God's light of holiness to come and dwell inside him in peace. That's why he said to Abimelech, I have digged this well, meaning no one did it for me. I did it myself. When Abraham swore an oath with Abimelech, it was more than finding peace and rest for his future family and generations to come. It's about Abraham wanting to make a resting place for God's holy light to dwell inside the temple, or I should say the vessel, of his soul. This is the message behind the well of oath called Beersheba. It's about carving out our own soul vessel to hold the living waters of God, just like when a person physically hews out of the rock a well to find water. Abraham said, I have digged this well. In other words, nobody else dug this well. Abraham did it by himself. Physically carving out a well is a spiritual analogy of Abraham fashioning, that is, carving out a vessel from his soul that would be capable of holding the living waters of God. In other words, Abraham carved out and fashioned a dwelling place for God's living waters to dwell in. Living waters is another way of saying the light of God, or his Holy Spirit, which is the fountainhead of all life. Abraham taught us we can do this ourselves. How? By using the tools of loving God and thy neighbor. Abraham and his wife Sarah were able to fashion a dwelling place inside their own soul so that God can come and dwell inside them forever in peace. Abraham and Sarah wanted God's light of holiness to come and dwell inside them in peace. Abraham wanted so much. That's why he swore an oath. He wanted it that much. And he repeated that oath seven times. Seven times in that place where he dug the well called Beersheba, or well of oath. For us, Abraham and Sarah are both examples of what our soul is capable of becoming. We too, brethren, can build a house. That is, we can carve out a dwelling place for God out of our own soul by using the tools of loving God and thy neighbor. We too can dig out our own well, that is, fashion our soul to hold the living waters of God. Abraham and Sarah drank in so much of God's light that their soul vessel began to spill over. It began to overflow like a water spring when it overflows its bank. just like Yeshua said on the day of Hoshana Rabbah, during the seventh day of the Feast of Sukkot. There in the Gospel of John, chapter 7, verse 37, it says, "In the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. And he that believeth on me, as the scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living waters." What are these rivers of living waters? Living waters is an analogy of the light of God's presence, His Holy Spirit. Now, during temple times, this holy light emanated from the dweller. In Hebrew, dweller is pronounced Shohen, which was inside the most holy place in between the two golden cherubims on top of the golden mercy seat. And today, for those who have been baptized and believe Yeshua is the Son of God, that holy light seeks to dwell inside the vessel of our soul. But it can only dwell there when we build a dwelling place for God's light, just like Abraham physically carved out the well in Beersheba. We too can carve out a dwelling place for God to reside in us. Physically carving a well to hold water is an analogy of fashioning our soul into a vessel that can hold the living waters of God's light in us, which means we're building a house for God to dwell in us. Now, the physical act of carving out a well, that is a water well by hand, requires great strength, stamina, and faith that if you dig deep enough, you will find water. Strength, stamina, and faith to keep on digging and shaping the wells are tools that symbolically represent the godly characteristics of love and obedience to God's word and love to our neighbor. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob brought us that knowledge through the story of their lives we're reading here in these parashas. They're true life stories about the patriarchs, teaching us that it is possible to develop our mind to a higher way of thinking, serving God and our fellow man. Humans are capable of manifesting higher levels of God-like thoughts and ideas into their everyday life, even to the smallest detail. When we can learn to do that, we're on the road of achieving control of everything in our life. And controlling everything includes having mastery over every aspect of our personality. How is this done, you say? Well, it's done through the example of Jacob's life. Jacob taught us we can synthesize our own high-stress moments that come upon us called tests and trials. And we have to learn how to bridge those high stress moments and bring them together by using God's characteristics of loving kindness. When we can learn to combine God's loving kindness together with those high stress moments of tests and trials, we're building an unseen bridge, just like Jacob saw in the vision of the ladder, which is the bridge between the two worlds. The physical world, which represents the bottom rung of the ladder on earth, and the spiritual world, which represents the top rung of the ladder. In Hebrew, the word for ladder is sulam. Sulam is Strong's H5551, and it means a staircase or a ladder. It comes from the Hebrew root word H5549, which means to raise yourself up. In other words, raise yourself from the lustful desires of our fleshly bodies, which represents earth, and climb up the ladder to God's house, to the high levels of godly character, to be exalted Exalted by whom? By God, who invites you into his house. By combining the bottom part of the ladder on earth with the top of the ladder in heaven, that creates an opening to God's gate in heaven and the entrance into God's house above. That's what Jacob meant when he awakened from his sleep. And he said in Genesis chapter 28, verses 16 and 17, it says, "And Jacob awakened out of his sleep, and he said, Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid and said, How dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Synthesizing those high-stress moments in our lives called tests and trials with the godly principles to receive for the sake of sharing with others is how we bridge or create a staircase, that is, a ladder between the two worlds of good and evil, the two worlds of take and give. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had the ability to bridge all of their high-stress moments in their lives. They understood how to bridge their own bad moments into something good. In other words, they took those bad situations and synthesized them into something good, or you could say they took a bad situation and turned it into something good. We can do this, brethren. We have it in us to do the same thing. Our minds have the ability to bring together the things that we can see that may look bad and connect them with the things we cannot see to make them turn out good. Human consciousness has the capability. We have that. It is inside us. That capability is strong in us. But it needs to break through that stony heart. We need to continue chipping away at that stony heart every day to create a dwelling place for God's light of goodness. Chipping away at the stony heart in hopes of finding water is an analogy of life's daily struggle. And no matter what unpleasant situation we find ourselves in, turn it into something good. Never, never stop your progress. Don't give up. Keep digging deeper until you reach the fountainhead of living waters. Now, we live our lives in the in-betweens, the ups and downs. And the final outcome of each situation is all about what you make it out to be. You get to choose the outcome. And whichever way you choose to go, whether good or bad, that's what will manifest into your own life. It's our own doing because God gave us free will. Therefore, we cannot blame God for all our troubles. The formula to live in the in-between has already been built. It was cast and established by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when Yeshua, our Messiah, came to dwell among us, he too established it. But he took it to a higher level, and he showed us it was possible to live in both worlds at the same time. And he demonstrated that by all the miracles he manifested. Human beings were designed by God so that we are constantly changing our old ways of thinking so that we're always moving on to the next chapter in our lives. Life is always challenging us to get out of our own comfort zone. So when we think that things are not going our way, that's bad. No, they're not. They're just opportunities in our lives to get us to move to the next chapter in our lives. Every day, God is giving us a challenge, that is, an opportunity to accomplish our mission that we were sent here on earth to do. Every day, God is challenging us to get out of our comfort zone, to get out of that warm, cozy box of living comfortably, and move on to another stage in our life. That's the message we're to learn from Jacob. Jacob knew how to balance and synthesize both sides of good and evil. Jacob understood when life gives you lemons, turn them into lemonade and keep moving forward to start your next chapter of life. Every time we can successfully get out of our comfort zone and go on to the next chapter in our life, we're interacting with the two sides of sharing and giving. We're interacting with the two sides of Abraham and Isaac and the two sides of Jacob and Esau. When we can learn to successfully synthesize the two sides of good and bad and balance them together, we will no longer be mixed up or confused about all those negative events happening in our lives. When we can learn to synthesize the two, now life will begin to show you the miracles of your hard-earned work. And now we begin another chapter in Jacob's ever-moving life to get out of his comfort zone and continue to carve out a dwelling place in his soul for God's light to dwell in. And now we're in Parashah Vayishlach. Vayishlach is Hebrew for "and he sent." It's about Jacob facing the anger of his brother, the personal tragedy of losing his wife Rachel, and his high-stress life and death moment when he wrestles with the angel of Esau, and later on when he struggles with the mental anguish of his daughter Dinah being raped and with his sons taking revenge on the city of Shechem. So let's read the first two verses of this week's Parashah Vayishlach, and we're reading from a Christian Bible, beginning in Genesis chapter 32, verse 3. It says, "And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother into the land of Seir, the country of Edom." Now Edom is Petra. Petra is a rock place. It's a red place. Where the rocks there are red. In verse 4 it says, "And he commanded them, saying, Thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob says thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now." It says, "And Jacob sent messengers." Now in Hebrew, messengers are called malachim, or angels. Malachim is Strong's H4397. And the singular form is malach, and it means to dispatch as a deputy, maybe a messenger specifically of God, that is an angel. Also, it can mean a prophet, a priest, or a teacher, or an ambassador such as a king or the king's messenger. And it could also mean an angelic being. In other words, malach, or a messenger, can be a human being or an angel of God disguised as a human being. Now, logically speaking, if we are to assume the messengers Jacob sent were humans, that would make more sense than to believe these were spirit beings or angels of God disguised as human beings. But let's say these messengers were angels of God described, or I should say disguised, as human being. How would you know? Because last week we read about a certain place called the place where Jacob came to lay down and sleep, and then he had a vision, which can also be called a lucid dream, where he saw a ladder from earth to heaven, and there were angels ascending and descending this ladder. So let's go back to refresh our memory about this vision Jacob experienced. It begins in Genesis chapter 28, verses 11 through 17. And it says, beginning to read in verse 11, And he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to the heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereupon thou liest, unto thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And then it says in verse 16, and Jacob awakened out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid and said, how dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. We read this amazing story in last week, Parashah Vayetzeh, and we finished that parashah when Jacob, along with all his family and possessions, leaves Laban, his father-in-law's house. So let's pick up the story there. In Genesis chapter 31, verse 21, it says, so he fled with all that he had, and he rose up and passed over the river and set his face toward the Mount of Gilead. And it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob was fled, and he took his brethren with him and pursued after him 7 days' journey. And they took him in the Mount of Gilead. Now, after that encounter with Laban, Jacob and all his family and possessions continued to move on. But something miraculously happened along the way to Bethel. And remember, Bethel means house of God, right? It's also called the place. Now, let's read that account in Genesis chapter 32, verse 1. It says, beginning to read in verse 1, Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. So he called the name of that place Mahanaim, Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Verse 4, instructing them, thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus shall you say, your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. Now, in this passage, it says Jacob came across God's angels. Then he sends out messengers. Okay? He comes across God's angels, and then it says he sends out messengers to meet with his brother Esau. From this translation, we would have never realized that the angels Jacob met are the very same messengers he sends to his brother. Why? Because the Hebrew word behind both of these English words, angels of God and messengers, is the Hebrew word malachim, literally meaning messengers. In Hebrew, an angel or messenger is called malach. Malach is Strong's H4397. In the first four verses of Genesis 32, we read the angels of God met Jacob. And Jacob sends these angelic messengers to Esau with a message. Now, who were these messengers? They were angels of God disguised as human beings, and Jacob knew it, and he gave them instructions to go to Esau, his brother, to let him know he was coming home. So these angelic messengers deliver the message from Jacob and return back to Jacob, informing him that Esau is coming to meet him with his army. It says that in Genesis chapter 32, verse 6, it says, "And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him." Now, when Jacob hears the message, he says in the next verse, verse 7, "Then Jacob was greatly afraid and was distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks, and the herds, and the camels, into two companies." Note, between the word distressed and he divided, something is missing. And we'll get to that in a moment. In Genesis chapter 32, verse 8, continue to read, it says, "And he said, If Esau cometh to the one company and smite it, then the company which is left shall escape." So what happened in verse 7? In that in-between space where it says distressed and he divided. Well, Jacob says a prayer. He said a prayer there. Beginning to read in verse 9 of Genesis 32, it says, "And Jacob said a prayer, and he said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Jehovah who has sustained me, return, or who has said it unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will do thee good. I am not worthy the least of all thy loving kindnesses and of all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. For with my staff I pass over this Jordan, and now I am become two companies. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and smite me, the mother with the children. And thou saidest, I surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." Here is where the prayer ends. And the next thing he does is to prepare a lot of gifts for his brother Esau, and he separates them. Beginning to read in verse 13 of Genesis chapter 32, it says, "And he lodged there that night, and took that which he had within him, a present for Esau his brother." Now skipping to verse 24 of Genesis 32, it says, "And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day." Verse 25, "And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, Let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go except thou bless me. And he said unto him, What is thy name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." Now, skipping to verse 30, it says, "And Jacob called the name of that place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And Jacob renamed Jabbok to Peniel, which means the face of God, because he saw God's face to face, and he did not die. Now, keep this phrase in mind, the phrase that says, "I have seen God face to face." Because we're going to revisit a similar phrase in Genesis chapter 33, verse 10. Now also I want you to remember that Jacob and Esau were twins. They were not identical. They were not identical. And Jacob had not seen Esau for 34 years, because when the brothers parted ways, Jacob studied 14 years at the house of Eber, who was Shem's son. Then he goes to Haran and works 20 years for Laban. Now that's a total of 34 years. And you know, in 34 years, people's faith can change a lot in that amount of time. And we pick up the story in Genesis chapter 33, verse 1. It says, "And Jacob lifted up his eyes, and look, and behold, Esau was coming, and with him 400 men." Now, how did Jacob know which one was Esau? And it says, "And he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto two handmaids." Verse 2 of Genesis 33, it says, "And he put the handmaid and her children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. And he himself passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came to his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." What's the Torah teaching us in this episode? From all the accounts we read about Esau, we've learned that Esau is an angry man, which means when a person harbors anger inside themselves, it means they have no grace in them. Why? Because they're filled with pride. Esau always believed and behaved as if he was doing the right thing all the time, like the scripture says. And we've read this scripture many times in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12. There it says, "There is a way which seems right unto a man, but the end of are the ways of death." In this parasha, the Torah is asking the reader a question. It's asking you and me a question. Well, what's the question? The question is, are you an angry person? And if the answer is yes, that means you're behaving like Esau. But if you truly want to change that kind of behavior, you have to behave like Jacob, because we learn in this parasha that Jacob was a very humble man. He never let anger get the better of him. Now, have you ever met an angry person? And if you have, what's the one thing that sticks out the most from an angry person? Well, they never want to listen to you, right? And they won't tell you that because inside their heart and mind, they're afraid of you becoming angry at them. And angry people hide a lot of secrets. We should all know, when a person is angry at you, that's the Esau coming out. Jacob is the opposite of Esau, meaning he knows there's never a good reason to get angry or upset at anyone who's angry at you, which means we should never get upset at anybody or just somebody. You can't get upset. We're not supposed to get upset when they do something wrong to us. Why? Because getting upset at them will only make matters worse. When a person is at the height of an angry emotional outburst, what typically happens is this. They become so agitated in their state of anger that it blocks their ability to understand or reason out what you're trying to tell them about what they're doing is wrong. When you try to tell them what they're doing is wrong, what usually happens? Well, they shut down. When someone is talking to you and they begin to scream at you because they're upset and angry at you, are they capable of listening? Most likely not. Why? Because most people, when they're yelling or screaming at you, they'll retreat to the deepest, darkest place inside themselves, and they lock themselves in that spot and begin to vomit all kinds of nasty words toward you. And at the same time, they don't want to listen to you, even if you're trying to help them. And the lesson for us is simple. There should not be any reason for us to get angry or upset. So when you begin to feel you're getting upset, what do? When you feel the anger coming upon you, shut it out. How? Figuratively speaking, you use your imagination. Use your imagination, taking that negative feeling, and with all your mental strength, you bind it up with a strong rope. And after you bound it, take it to the door, toss it out, then close the door behind you. Now that's a power you possess inside your imagination. You can take any negative feeling, bind it up in your imagination, and throw it out the door. And it's not that hard to do. You think you can do that, brethren? The process of using our imagination to bind any negative thought or feeling is a powerful force we each have. And it can overcome any strong negative feeling, negative force. Anger is a strong negative force that can be easily overcome. And for those of us who follow Yeshua's teaching, there should never be any reason to get upset or seek revenge or retaliate with anger at anyone. It says in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verses 17 through 18, beginning to read in verse 17, God says, "Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart. Thou shalt surely rebuke thy neighbor and not bear sins because of him. Thou shalt not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am Jehovah." Our Creator is teaching us it's okay to rebuke your neighbor when they break one of his laws right in front of you. But at the same time, you're not supposed to take vengeance or bear any grudge against them. Why? Because getting upset or angry is the result of bearing a grudge and taking vengeance. And that's never going to lead to a good outcome. Ask yourself, what good could come out of getting upset or angry? So our Creator is teaching us that when you are in control of your anger, you're beginning to learn what it is to be a humble person. Controlling one's anger is what leads a person into humility. When Jacob wrestled with the angel of Esau, do you think Jacob's anger was aroused? Really? Do you think it was aroused? Well, I got news for you. No, it wasn't. How do we know? Because it says in Genesis chapter 32, verse 25, when he saw that he, meaning Esau's angel, prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. Then in verse 26, it adds, and he, meaning Esau's angel, said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And Jacob says, "I will not let thee go except thou bless me." Jacob wrestled with the angel and pinned it down. That is, he bound the angel so that it could not escape. During all that time, Jacob wrestled with the angel. He never displayed any anger whatsoever. How do we know this? Well, we know this because when he wrestled with Jacob, it was Esau, his brother, he was wrestling with. Now, our answer is found in when Jacob sees his brother Esau for the first time in 34 years. That's where the answer is found. Let's pick up that narrative in Genesis 33, verse 10. Speaking to Esau, Jacob said, "Nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face, as though I have seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Remember, when Jacob wrestled with the angel, what did Jacob say about that encounter? He said, I saw God's face to face and did not die. Now remember, Jacob wrestled with this angel, Esau's angel. When a wrestler is engaged with an opponent, they're so close to each other that their faces come in contact with each other. Literally, they're face to face. How can anyone who's wrestling forget their opponent's face when they're that close to each other? When Jacob talks to his brother Esau, now remember again, Jacob hadn't seen Esau in 34 years. That is, again, 14 years in Eber's house plus 20 years living in Haran equals 34 years. What does Jacob say to his brother? He says to him, I have seen thy face as though I have seen the face of God. Why would he say that? Because when he wrestled with the angel, he saw the angel's face and didn't know who he was wrestling with. Then the next time he sees that face again, it's when he sees Esau coming toward him. The angel Jacob wrestled with was disguised as Esau's face to include Esau's size, weight, age, and bodily appearance. Now the next chapter in Jacob's life is very distressful. When he takes his family and settles down in the parcel of land Jacob brought that is purchased from the children of Hamor, the Hivite. There Jacob is confronted with another life or death moment. Dinah, his daughter, is kidnapped and raped by Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite. Now let's read this story, beginning to read in Genesis chapter 34, verses 1 through 12. Beginning to read in verse 1, it says, And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Question. What was Dinah doing going out by herself to see the daughters of the land? It is apparent that she was not escorted. She went out on her own. In other words, she sneaked out of the house when no one was looking. Verse 2. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. In other words, he raped her. And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel. Now remember that word, damsel. And spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father Hamor, saying, Get me this damsel to wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved. And they were very wroth, because he had wrathfully fallen in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which things ought not to be done. And Hamor communed with them, saying, The soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you, give her unto wife. Give her unto him to wife. And make ye marriage with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you, and you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father and unto her brethren, Let me find grace in your eyes, and what you shall say unto me, I will give. Ask me, never so much dowry and gift. And I will give according as ye have said unto me, but give me the damsel to wife. In verse 3 and verse 12 of chapter 34, we come across the word damsel. In Hebrew, this word is pronounced na'ar. Na'ar is exactly the same word we spoke about in Parashat Toldot. In Genesis 24, verse 16, it says there, and the damsel was fair to look upon, a virgin. Neither had any man known her, and she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. The Torah calls Rebekah a damsel, which we've already mentioned in the past is a girl who is younger than 12 and a half years old. In Genesis chapter 34, verse 3 and verse 12, the Torah describes Dina as Hana'ar. Ha means the, Na'ar means the damsel. Na'ar means younger than 12 and a half years old, which according to the Masorah tradition is pronounced as if were spelled Hana'ara. In these verses, the Talmud explains that when this word is spelled in full, it means a girl between 12 and 12 and a half years old. But when it's spelled without the final hey, it refers to any girl who is younger than 12 and a half. And in this case, we can surmise Dina's age could not have been more than 12 and a half years old when Shechem kidnapped her. This is why Shechem said, take me this girl for a wife. You can find that in Genesis 34, verse 4. Shechem calls her Yalda. Yalda is strong. H3207. It's the feminine form of H3206, which means a lass or a damsel. But when the final hey of Hana'ara is missing, it's pronounced Hanar, which means any girl who is younger than 12 and a half. Now we find this word being used again in Genesis chapter 34, verse 19, but this time in the masculine form. It says, and the young man, that word, young man, deferred not to do the thing because he had delight in Jacob's daughter and was more honorable than all the house of his father. Here the phrase young man in Hebrew is also pronounced na'ar. It's the same word, the exact very same word used to describe Dina. Na'ar is Strong's H5288, and it means a boy from the age of infancy to adolescence. So we can surmise Shechem was a young adolescent man who just reached puberty. Now, if the Torah describes Dina, the damsel, as Na'ar, younger than 12 and a half years old, and the same word is used to describe Shechem, but in the opposite gender, young man, we can determine that both Dina and Shechem were younger than 12 and a half years old. So what happens after Shechem said to Jacob and his sons, give me the damsel to wife? In Genesis chapter 34, verses 13, beginning to read there, it says, and the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully, and said, because she had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent to you, if ye will be as we be, that is, every male of you be circumcised. Beginning to read in verse 24, it says, and unto Hamor said and unto Hamor and unto Shechem his son hearken, all that went out of the gate of the city, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of the city. Verse 25, and it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, that is Simon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword, and came upon the city boldly, and slew all the male. And they slew Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah out of Shechem's house, and went out. And the sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and spoiled the city, because they had defiled their sister. How many were killed, you say? The Torah does not tell us. However, in the book of Jasher, chapter 33, verse 1, it says, and the number of all the male that were circumcised were 645 men and 246 children. Now, what was Jacob's response when he heard that his two sons, Simeon and Levi, had done to all the males inhabitants of the city of Hamor the Hivite? In Genesis chapter 34, verse 30, it says, and Jacob said unto Simon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed and my house. After that episode, God tells Jacob and his family to leave and go up to Bethel. And as he journeyed to Bethel, it said, beginning to read in verse 5 of Genesis chapter 35, it says, and they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. Now, if you want to learn more about this episode in Jacob's life, you can read all the details about what happened when the two sons of Jacob attacked the city of Hamor and the aftermath thereafter. And you can find that whole episode in the book of Jasher, chapters 34 through chapters 35. It's a very interesting read. So, what did we learn from this parasha and from all the previous parashas up to this point? What we learned is our Creator is and always be there to help us despite our own shortcomings. We've learned that He created our universe perfect, and He created mankind, now listen to this, He created mankind perfectly imperfect. Kind of funny, right? Perfectly imperfect is an oxymoron. And some of you will say, well, what's an oxymoron? An oxymoron is a combination of contradictory words. Examples are cruel kindness, clearly confused, alone together, open secret, found missing, and deafening silence. So why did God make us perfectly imperfect? And the universe perfect, meaning if the universe is perfect, what is left for us to create if the universe is perfect? Well, we can create something perfect within ourselves. Well, what can we create? We can create love instead of hate, wisdom instead of stupidity, humility instead of pride, mercy instead of judgment, love and tolerance instead of anger. When we can do that every moment of our life, we've fixed those broken pieces inside ourselves, meaning our imperfections are now perfect. And now that they're perfect, we can become one with God's creation, which is perfect. And we can invite God to come and dwell inside our soul's vessel. Nobody gave that to me. I repaired that myself. I synthesized and fixed my own imperfections on my own. God only gave me the opportunities we call tests and trials to fix what is broken inside me. And when it's all over and we go to meet our Maker, you can stand before Him and say, "Look, Father, look, the 10 talents, that is, those 10 opportunities, those tests and trials you gave me, I turned them into 10 positive talents." And the Master will reply, same as in Matthew 25, verse 21. His Master replied, "Well done. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your Master's happiness." Thank you for listening. And remember, hear and do God's word with happiness and joy. Love your neighbor. Speak good to all people. Spread the message. Continue your studies. Let your light shine. And may God continue to bless you all. Shabbat shalom, everyone.